translation of the word sadhu is awesome. That's what it means. So that was awesome. Dear Ajahn, I often heard that the Buddha didn't want to teach until a deva requested him to do so. What really happened? Now, my understanding of that, because when you are fully enlightened, all the desires fade away. You're so still that you just totally disappear. Unless somebody asks you to teach. You'd be so still, but it'd be like an avalanche of Dhamma. Just you need just one little cause to get that avalanche to start falling. And that's like a Buddha after his enlightenment, so perfectly still. No desire, no thinking at all. So he would have just faded away. But someone came to ask him to teach. And because he asked him, oh yeah, might as well. Just that tiny little bit of asking was what conditioned the Buddha to teach. But who was the person who asked him? Does anybody know? This is not a trick question. Sahampati. Yeah, who was he? Sahampati was also, in the previous life, a monk with Kassapa the Buddha. That's also in the Anguttara Nikaya. Sahampati was also a monk with Kassapa the Buddha, but Sahampati became an anagami, a non-returner. And so he was looking out for his mate, now Siddhartha Gautama, and found out that his friend had got enlightened, the Buddha. So Sahampati came down to ask him, please teach. There's some with little dust in their eyes, especially in Australia. We don't have much dust over here. This is a very, very clean air. But if you go to Indonesia or Singapore, Malaysia, when all those fires are burning, there's a lot of dust over there. So this is a great place to teach the Dhamma, where people have little dust in their eyes. And so he said, yeah, okay. And then he decided to teach. They call it Brahma Sahampati, but it's not some sort of god. It was an anagami, a non-returner. And the other person who later came down to actually to congratulate the Buddha was Gatikara. It's in the Dewa Putta Sanghita. He also came down and said to the new Buddha, we used to be friends together in the same village in the time of Kassapa the Buddha. You know, I was an anagami then. And now, congratulations, you're now a Buddha. Well done. We were friends before. Two friends congratulating each other. It's very nice. It gives you another idea of the Buddha's previous life, and that is from the suttas. What to do after jhana if it happens at home, far from your guidance? You think it's far from my guidance, but I've already brainwashed you. The suggestions are already in there. Just like I mentioned, so much of my practice after Ajahn Chah passed away, disappeared, years after, when the guidance was needed. At that time, you remember exactly what Ajahn Chah said. It's weird. As if like it was waiting for the time when you got to that particular stage of meditation, and all those words which you did not understand at the time suddenly came up to your mind and made sense. So I know some of you have told me during the interviews that some of the stuff which I talk about, nimittas and jhanas and stream winning and arahat and psychic powers, is a lot of gobbledygook for you. You don't understand it. It's way beyond your experience so far. But don't worry about that. I do this on purpose. Because it lodges in your mind. Just waiting until that experience of meditation arrives in you, maybe years from now. And you remember that teaching. Subconsciously, you don't know that you remember, but you remember it and it starts to do its work. And that's the incredible thing about the Dhamma. So that's why I don't mind talking about very deep stuff. And even though people don't understand a word I'm saying, I don't care, because later on you will. Because that's what happened with me, with Ajahn Chah. So what happened after jhana, if it happened at home, you will know. Dear Bhante, thanks for having me here for 9 days retreat. Deeply thanks for your putting up with me. No, I'm putting a lot of effort teaching us. For putting a lot of effort teaching us and spend a lot of time on interview sessions. I do not get jhana, but I can see I have lots of progress, which I'll bring home, continue to practice, and I will get it someday as a gift offering to you. Cross fingers. Yeah. It happens. So you do make progress. And the other thing, which I usually say, if you aim very high, you know, jhana's enlightenment, that may be beyond you, but that forces you to actually get higher up. And what you do here is much more than if I'd have set the bar lower. And you'll continue practice. I made a lot of progress, which is wonderful, which is great. So well done. And you've got the end. Thanks, Master. Because I remember that's what they call in some Chinese traditions, they call the monk Master. But I used to watch Doctor Who when I was a kid. And the Master was this really evil guy. So that's, I never liked being called the Master. Apparently they still have Doctor Who. And does the Master still exist? Is he still the bad guy? Yeah, okay. Anyway, I was in Hong Kong a couple of years ago and they wanted to have a discussion between a Zen monk and a Theravada monk. So I was a Theravada monk and they got a Zen monk in. And there's supposed to be a dialogue between two masters, they said. And I suggested, why is it always monks? Why don't you get two nuns to have a dialogue? A Theravada nun and a Mahayana nun. And we could have the dialogue between two mistresses. And I didn't think that was funny. I thought that was very funny. If you call a monk, you know, the teacher master, you should call the nuns mistresses. So some of you men have got some mistresses. It totally means something totally different, doesn't it? The language is strange. Ajahn Brahm, if our actions are conditioned, another will thing, if our actions are conditioned and happen according to willpower, how the actions are different from one person to the other? What factors determine individuals' reactions? It's all the causality, everything you've been exposed to. So people who have been exposed and brainwashed by Ajahn Brahm react differently. I was telling one of the doctors here, was it here or somewhere else? That I had this idea, and it's a very good idea. Why is it that when you are sick, you got some fever or some pain or, you know, you got whatever it is, you go to the doctor and you say, doctor, there's something wrong with me. Which straight away stigmatizes illness and makes you feel guilty. So you've done another thing, you've done wrong again, you're sick. And that just makes the sickness worse. Being sick is natural. It's the body's healthy way of fighting infections or fevers or viruses, back to whatever it is. It's natural. And because of that, I have been telling people for years that when you go to see the doctor with some complaint, you tell your doctor, doctor, there is something right with me. I'm sick again. Well, what that does, when you tell the doctor there's something right with me, I've got Ebola, I've got cancer, I've got the bubonic plague, whatever it is, there's something right with me, I've got the plague again. What that is doing is taking away the guilt and negativity from sickness. So it's bad enough, you know, not feeling well, but having this emotional sense of failure, not being good enough, I'm wrong, there's something wrong with me, is actually a negative psychology. So, I've been telling people for years, if there's something wrong with you, go to the doctor and you tell your doctor there's something right with me. I'm sick again. And people actually do that now. And the doctors around Perth, when that happens, and oh God, here comes another one of Ajahn Brahm's people. But it's good, and because of that, that is why people's actions are different. They've been brainwashed by me. If they're brainwashed by someone else, they do it a different way. So that's where it comes from. Not your willpower, but mine. And my willpower, I said, comes from Ajahn Chah, and this comes from somebody else. So it's all just this web of interactions. You are talking about previous births many times in your talks. If there is non-self, what is transferring from one birth to the other? What is karma? So imagine, the best simile I've come up with, imagine you eat a mango. And once you've eaten the mango, you take the seed and you plant it in your garden. And you can actually see the seed coming out of the mango, you can see yourself planting it in the soil. And maybe you can actually just, you know, if it's not too deep, you can see the mango splitting and a little green shoot coming out from the split in the mango. And that green shoot from the seed going up, up, up until it penetrates the surface of the earth. And you can see once it penetrates the surface of the earth, it just looks like a piece of grass. But it grows taller than the grass and the stem becomes a little bit wooden. And you can see that's a small tree growing. It grows bigger and bigger until it's a sapling. And the sapling puts branches out and grows bigger and thicker over the years until it's a small tree. And it gets to that stage, you know, quite a high tree now, but not fully matured, when you can see the first flowers come out on the edges of, or the top of the leaves, or the stems of the leaves somewhere. And those flowers, you can see them blossom, and you can see the base of the flower starts to swell and swell. And it's a tiny thing, first of all, green, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and it becomes a mango. And once it's ripe, you can see it change color from green to yellow, maybe red. It's a ripe mango, so you pluck that mango and you eat it. So you see the whole process from the first mango to the second mango. What went across from one mango to the next? It's a continuous process. And you can observe every part of that process, a cause and effect, one thing leading to another. But nothing goes across. That is like the human, the stream of consciousness, going from one moment to another moment in this life, and also past that death moment, and into a new life, just this stream. And with a mango, if it's a new tree, it's not an apple tree, it's a mango tree. So nothing actually goes across, but there is some conditioning there in the original mango, which is going to be there in the next mango. It's a mango, not an apple. If the last mango was sweet, the first mango, the next mango is liable to be sweet. If the first mango was drought resistant, then the second tree is liable to be drought resistant. So there is something which goes across, but it's like a character, it's a karma, it's an inclination, it's a property, not a thing. If you look at the things, you know that every molecule of that original mango seed is changed, and probably new molecules, new elements, new atoms in there. The old ones are all gone because they all just regenerate. One dies, another is born again, even within the mango. So this is actually very similar to the way that human life goes from one world to the next. Just this process. One thing causing the next. So it's not a thing which goes across, it's a process which continues. Many, many thanks, Ajahn Brahm. I begin to enjoy the breath. It is really a pleasure. Might as well enjoy it because you've got to do it. Thank you again, showing me, guiding me for it. My first day got a miserable face, and today a happy face. When we die, how does our spirit choose our next body realm? Oh, it's a lot of time, it's where you deserve, where you think you deserve to get reborn. So I was saying this to someone today, it's amazing how people get into guilt. So you may have the doorways to a heaven realm for you. Say, oh no, I don't deserve that. I've been a bad person. And you actually send yourself to lower births or lower realms because you think that's what you deserve. It's the idea of punishment. And I was saying earlier that I know many people, they have relationships, really with good people, but they destroy the relationships. And I said, what are you doing that for? And it's because subconsciously they don't deserve to be happy. And so any happiness, any success, they tend to destroy it. And this is that terrible guilt which we people have. They don't think they deserve, they feel they're guilty, they've done something wrong. Other people have told you you've done something wrong, you believe them. And sometimes people say they've done something wrong, they can't remember what it was. Just like this young man who came just yesterday, apparently. I didn't see him. He wants to offer some tables to our monastery. And he was a brother, which I met in Queensland some years ago, and went to his father's house for the lunch. And this his son was there, and he said, "Oh, I've got another son who's not here." So why isn't he here? He says, "Because we haven't spoken together for years, for 7 years. Father and son hadn't spoken together." And then the other brother who's offering the tables, he was there. I said, "What happened?" He said, "I don't know. But they just haven't spoken. They can't stand each other." And so the younger brother who was there, I said, "Have you got your elder brother's telephone number?" He said, "Yeah, call him." "Can't. I order you. By the authority of Ajahn Brahm, the great monk, call him." I was only messing around. And he did, he called him, and I talked to him. He said, "I'm here, it's about time we came to your house to see your dad. I hadn't seen each other for 7 years." And he came. And I got the two of them in front of me. The first time they'd seen each other, 7 years, they still wouldn't look at each other and talk to each other. And I said, "His father," I said, "what happened 7 years ago?" His father said, "Actually, I don't know." Asked the son, "What happened?" "I don't know either." That's true. Actually, that was the case. Two people, something went wrong somewhere, and they just didn't know what it was. And they, 7 years, they forgot about the reason. They said, "Okay, enough's enough. Ask forgiveness of one another." They asked forgiveness of one another, and they're back together again. And I felt so proud of that. I'd done something really good. Father and son, apart for 7 years, and I got them together again. And so every time they're in Perth, they just come and see me and say thank you, and now they're doing a big offering for that. Wonderful. Why do we keep punishing ourselves? We don't know what we did. We did something wrong, I know that, so we don't allow ourselves to be happy. And that's a problem. That's why you send yourself into lower realms. But if you can just let go of the past, for goodness sake, you don't need to be punished. Punishment is the most stupid invention of human beings. You make a mistake. We all make mistakes. So when you make a mistake, what do? You acknowledge it. "Yeah, I stuffed up. I did something stupid." Next thing is you forgive it. No punishment. You're allowed to make mistakes. Everybody is allowed to make mistakes. And the next thing you do is you learn from it. You learn. "Oh, I made a mistake." If there's no fear involved of punishment, it means you don't hide it. And also, you can learn from it, you don't do it again. And that is the Buddhist way, taught by the Buddha in the Vinaya to the monks, to acknowledge, forgive and learn. No punishments. And then it means you don't need to choose a bad life. You can choose a good life next time. And there's many people here who will not get jhanas because you think you don't deserve it. You haven't overcome the guilt yet, the negativity. That first came up, there was a nun spending the rains retreat at Bodhinyana Monastery over the road, an Australian nun. And she was getting these incredible nimittas. And I was getting really excited. You know, she's going to get jhana within a day or two. She's really going for it. And then she got stuck. And at that time, I couldn't understand what the heck was going on. Everything I knew, she should have had great jhanas, but she just got stuck at this brilliant nimitta. And then she came to see me one day and she said, "I figured out why I can't get any further." And she said, "Because I realize I don't deserve to be happy. I don't deserve to be enlightened." And that was like a dagger to my heart. Why do you think like that? Because of her conditioning, brainwashing, time she was small or something, by her mum, by her teachers, never ever thinking they're good enough. And always feeling guilty, which means that she had this huge psychological block to happiness, especially big happiness. "No, not me. I don't deserve it. Other people are okay, but not me." And that was the only thing which was blocking her from the jhanas. And same which blocks you sometimes. You can't see it. It's really deep inside of you. The resistance to be free and happy because of guilt. And that is sometimes what sends you to a lower realm. So if you can understand all of this, you find you can be much happier in life, successful in whatever you do, because you understand you deserve to be happy. It's okay to be happy. So you go for it. And that's actually how you can choose a good realm in your next life, because you deserve it. New marketing slogan. This must be from one of the nuns. The Sangha, where building is never premature. Never premature. Never before its time. Yeah, okay, because monks and nuns are always building. Building this and building that and building something else. But sometimes it's your fault. You lay people, you say, oh, we need a new kitchen. Or we need a room so you can do long retreats. Or we need, what else do you need? It's easy to see what is needed. But the antidote to that is to see what we already have. At home, it's so easy to see how you need another room, an extension. The antidote to that is to see what you already have. It's easy to look and see, oh, we need a new kitchen. But the husband said, well, what about the kitchen we already have? So a lot of times, when you see what's missing, it gives rise to craving, desire. When you see what you already have, it's called gratitude. It leads to contentment. So this is good enough. Could be better. And sometimes people had all these ideas. They told me how to build a better meditation hall here. Number one, have non-squeak doors. So when you go into the meditation room, there's no squeaky. And you have floors where it's cushioned, so you can't hear people walking. And you know that some people complain it's too hot in the morning or it's too cold at night. So you have your own individual aircon. You pull it down and then it just gets the temperature just for you, just in your little space. It doesn't affect the person next to you. So you get your own aircon. And your cushions. Those cushions you're in, Zafus, they're so last century. Can't we have much better high-tech cushions these days? And so I started to think of high-tech cushions. Ones which are remote control, so you can actually, you've got the front, the back, the sides, and so you can actually, so you can enlarge the side one. If you've got a sore knee this side, you press a button and this one, it inflates through there and it pulls you off this way. Or it pulls you that way. And if you're cold, you can have heated underneath, just like those toilets they have in Japan and Korea. You sit on the thing and it's nice and warm, so you can actually have it heated, or if you're too hot, to cool it down. And for sloth and top, you have another button there, and you can have espresso, short black, or sort of Sri Lankan tea, because there's lots of Sri Lankan tea. And it just brews it for you, so have it hot and fresh, so you don't need to get up. You can just have a cup of coffee to get rid of the sloth and torpor. And there's many other minor adjustments you can get for your own high-tech meditation cushion. And sometimes people fantasize. Obviously, I thought of that because I wouldn't be able to tell you it. Sitting here, getting bored and say, okay, I'm going to invent a meditation cushion. But you can do that if you like, but isn't this good enough? That is good enough. And also, food. We should not just have people bring in dana. We should have like a menu. So in the evening, you write down what you want for tomorrow. You have vegetarian food, vegan food, meat food. You can have Indian, Sri Lankan, Thai, Chinese, Western. You can have the menu and you write it down in the evening and we send it to Bianca and she goes into town and brings it to you the following morning. And actually even going to the kitchen there, brought to your room, room service. Wouldn't that be wonderful? So there's no end to that type of thought. And that's where building comes from. You can always make it better, but isn't it good enough? How to forgive someone who had hurt me by her manipulation so that I had to do things against my will. You only get manipulated if you let the other person manipulate you. You don't need to. So, if another person tells you to do something, like, you know my trick, I told you any of you already. If they try to manipulate me by saying, you have to do this. Come on, you have to come to our temple. You have to come to my temple. What I keep on saying is, if you say no, they'll argue with you. If you say yes, you have to keep your promise. I can't do either of those. So my trick is when you invite me to come somewhere, say for your house, for a dana, I say, well, I'm a bit busy now, but I'll think about it. That's my trick. I say, I'll think about it. And there's some invitations I've been thinking about for about 6 or 10 years, I think now. And I'm not breaking my promise. I say, I'm thinking about it. I do think about it every now and again. I'm not going to go, but, you know, I think about it. And that just gets you off the hook. So people only manipulate you if you let them. And they start trying to find your buttons. They can only push your buttons if you've got one. So take off all your buttons. I don't mean literally, otherwise your trousers fall down. I mean just metaphorically. So no one can push anything. Yes? That was the whole point of that answer. Say, can you teach me how to be patient? And I put it down. I'm not ready yet. Wait for it. Don't rush. So by manipulation, they can only manipulate you if you let them. They get angry at you. They shout at you. Give them the 5 seconds of silence. After they shout at you. Because what most people do, they shout at you, they scold you, and then you give as good as you get. That misses a great opportunity. They scolded you, they've been shouting at you. When they're finished, which they have to take a breath, and they're looking at you, just be quiet for 5 seconds. Not out of fear. Total peacefulness. And give them a chance to reflect on what they've just said. Because if you're not talking, you're not reacting, the only thing they can be mindful of is what they've just said to you. And that gives them the opportunity to realize just how uncivilized, how grossly they've behaved. And that's a very effective way of working. They're shouting, you're scolding, you're really angry. After they finish, just sit there, 5 seconds. Let them think about what they just said. And that really teaches them a great lesson. You don't need to tell them they've been uncivilized. They'll just argue back. Let them see it for themselves. With the 5 seconds of silence. And manipulating you, a lot of times it's because they try and get your guilt. You're a bad sister. You're a bad mother. So the best thing is to say, admit it. Yeah, I'm a bad sister. So they can't manipulate you anymore. Oh, really? Oh, you're a bad monk. Yeah, I am a bad. I'm a lazy monk. So then they can't manipulate me anymore. Just agree with them. And then you can go off. Just like when I was in Malaysia. There was a lot of people in Malaysia. It happened in Singapore too. They were Buddhists. And when they were getting very old, they were sick. They were in hospital dying. And they had maybe had one son or one daughter who joined one of these Christian sects. You know, the charismatic evangelical Christians. And this son, he obviously cared about his father. And his pastor told him, your father's going to go to hell unless he believes in Jesus Christ. He better convert him. And so they go to the bedside with their pastor and their mates. Lots of them. I don't know why they have to go in numbers. They must be scared converting someone by themselves. So they go in large numbers and they try and convert their father. And the father, I'm a Buddhist, get out of here. But he's sick, he's dying, he's weak, he wants a bit of peace. And it's a big problem. In Sri Lanka, Singapore, in Malaysia. So someone asked me what we should do to solve that problem. I said, it's so easy. If you're a devout Buddhist, you've been a Buddhist for years and you love Buddhism, and your son, who's a born-again Christian, comes with his mates and tries to convert you, convert! Become a Christian! Because as soon as you're a Christian, the pastor, his mates, and your son will leave. And as soon as they're outside of the ward, you can convert back to being a Buddhist again. You can convert one, or you can convert the other. That's such a skillful means. That's the only way you get any peace. They won't leave you alone until you've converted. It's So that's what they use to manipulate you, but you can be smarter. Just go, okay, I'm a Christian. Hallelujah. Praise the Lord. Whatever you want to say. Okay? And then they're out there. Yay! You know, my father's a Christian now. And as soon as they're out of the room, put down seven Uncle Charlie. I'm a very sneaky bunk. And that way you're not manipulated by people anymore. So be smart. Does Theravada monastic stay in a Mahayana monastery? If so, how do they keep their precepts? Or you would avoid going to such monasteries? In that case, where can Theravada nuns go? Yeah, you can go to Mahayana monasteries because the precepts are very similar. We have the same Vinaya. There's a few which are different, but they're all good people, and it's good enough to stay in a Mahayana monastery or a Theravada monastery or a Vajrayana monastery. And a lot of times, people make allowances. They see you a Theravada monk staying in the Mahayana monastery, they make an allowance. They look after you, make sure you get the food before midday. They'll cook it specially for you. And they look after you because they know the differences and they're very happy. If a Mahayana monk came to Bodhinyana, of course they'd be looked after. We had the Korean monks, Mahayana, from the Jogji order. And we have great fun together. So they come and stay, and there's no problems at all. And so where can the Theravada nuns go? They should go to not the Mahayana monastery or the Vajrayana monastery. The Theravada nuns should go to the Hahayana monastery. It's much more fun, the best fun monastery in the world, where the Hahayana people live. Can the jhana feel like if you are going to die? If it's not like the body is going to die, because when the body dies, it's always painful and uncomfortable, dying. Jhana is just so peaceful, so pleasant, so much happiness. So that is a huge difference between dying and getting jhana. However, there are similarities, and the similarities, when you die, your five senses shut down, your body disappears, because it's all worn out, it's gone, it's busted. And what happens in the jhana is, again, your five senses stop, and your body vanishes, but it's not busted, it's just, you know, put aside for a while. And you do see the light, just like when you die, that light they call the nimitta, you see when you die. So there's many similarities, but it's not really the same. But it's like something is dying, like you're letting go of something which you've been holding on to for too long. That type of letting go, like you're dying to some past attachment, that is fair enough. Dear Ajahn, this is a short notice, but is there any possibility for a guided meta-meditation session before the end of this retreat? If your karma is ripe, you might get a guided meditation on metta. But if your karma is not very good, then it will not happen. Who knows what tomorrow will bring? It's uncertain. Wait and see. If one has broken one of the five precepts, what can you do to cancel the consequence of that? You've got to be punished. There was this Anagarika. This is the Anagarika story. This person training to become a monk. And he came to see me one morning in Bodhinyana Monastery. He said he hadn't slept all night. He felt terrible. He had to come up to me as the abbot to confess his sin. What did he do? He said the evening before, he was so hungry. He snuck into the kitchen when no one was around. He made himself a sandwich when no one could see him. And he ate it. In the afternoon, he broke the precepts. He was terrible. And he felt so guilty. And so I told him, he looked at me and he was almost like crying. I felt so sorry for him. And I thought he'd murdered someone by the expression on his face. And I told him, wonderful, you've confessed. Marvelous. Now, you know, you're totally forgiven. There's no punishments. Now learn. I gave him the strategies. Look, I said, if you're hungry in the afternoon, first of all, eat more at lunchtime. Eat a bit more. And also, if you do get hungry, there's so many things you can eat in the afternoon and the evening. You got the cheese and the chocolate, the apple juice, the every juice under the sun you can eat these days. You can have this V8 where you've got lots of different fruits and vegetables. What else do you have? Honey, you can have sugar. There's so much you can be hungry. Get a jar of honey and eat that. Bees survive on that all winter time, so you can do okay. So I gave him all the strategies. And I said, you can go now. And he looked at me. And he said, aren't you going to punish me for breaking the precepts? I said, no, we don't do punishments here. You're free. These are strategies to learn from the experience. And don't do it again, that's all. And he looked at me and he said, Ajahn Brahm, if you do not punish me, I know my character, he said, I'll do it again. And he put me on the spot. He wanted to be punished. So that was where, thinking outside the box very quickly, I devised a traditional Australian punishment for him. It just coincidence, I was reading a book that morning called The Fatal Shore by Robert Hughes about the early history of Australia. When any of the convicts, if they broke even the smallest rules, they were flogged with this really brutal whip called the Cat of Nine Tails. Have you heard about that, the Cat of Nine Tails? So I told him that I'd just be reading about that. And I said, well, this is Australia. So I looked him in the eye and said, if you want to be punished, I'm going to give you 50 strokes of the cat. And this poor Anna Garrica, his face went white. You can see his lips started to quiver. He didn't need to have psychic powers to read his mind. That's not the sort of punishment I was asking for. He really thought I was going to whip him. Crazy fellow. So I looked him in the eye again. He was really serious. This was big stuff. And I said, I'm going to sentence you to 50 strokes of the cats. At that time, we did have two cats in our monastery. Find one of them and stroke it. One, two, three. Learn some kindness. That is your punishment, so you can forgive yourself. So that became the Buddhist punishment of 50 strokes of the cat. A dog would do, but you know, they have the cat of nine tails. That worked really well. But 50 strokes of a dog would be fine. To learn some kindness. And then you don't need to be punished anymore. So that was what we did. If you've broken one of the five precepts, that's what you have to do. 50 strokes of the cat. It's okay. Sorry?
Spot's not very friendly, though.
Spot, though, you can always find one over in your house or somewhere else. There's lots of cats around. Get a dog. If you can't find a cat, stroke the teddy bear 50 times. 50 strokes of the teddy bear. I feel a bit apprehensive about going back home tomorrow. The chores of relationships. Any words of wisdom? Don't go. Obvious. No brainer. Do monks denounce nimittas quite regularly, or is something that happens every now and then? What's the difference between every now and then and regularly? When the causes are ripe, then you see them. It's not to do with you. It's not your abilities or your skills. It's just the causes. The causes are there, and then it happens. There is a theory that all physical illnesses are due to unresolved emotions or traumas that manifest in themselves as cancer, heart disease, lung and kidney disease. What about the other things like Ebola? Or what's that? Really nice diseases. I don't know. Anyway, Ebola. For example, cancer is considered to be a disease of fear. What is your view on this, please? Also, by extension of this logic, it will be interesting to know the incidence of cancer amongst monks and nuns. Cancer amongst monks. I haven't got cancer. I'm a very healthy monk. Because I eat healthy food. Honestly, the secret to living to a long old age is to eat, or not to eat, sorry, to drink. Long life milk. That's what it says on there, long life milk. It's obvious. So, yeah, there's something to say unresolved emotions or trauma does mess up the body, but to actually to link it, you know, fear to this disease or that disease, I think that's a bit much. Somebody did actually, Daniel, show me one of these TED video talks, and there some really smart researcher had found, was wondering, why do some people have very, very difficult jobs and don't get heart disease? Other people have very difficult jobs and do get heart disease. The same amount of responsibility and stress. Some people get heart disease, some don't. And she made this wonderful little observation. It's the people who have the right attitude to stress. A challenge. Something just to, you know, get your teeth into. A wonderful thing to do. You know, they're the ones who don't get heart disease. The ones who get negative, keep complaining. Oh, why do I have to do this? Why do I always have to answer the question? All those nuns over there, they just sit there and do nothing. Why me? Why do I always have to do this? This is a... Now that type of person gets sick. The same amount of work, but your attitude is totally different. So if you're working for a wonderful organization like the Buddhist Society, and they give you extra work to do in the office, if you say, this is unfair, I should be getting that, you get heart disease. Say, wonderful. Give me more. It's a great opportunity to do more good karma for the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. Thank you so much for giving me more work to do. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. Then you'll never get heart disease, Timmy. She works in my admin office. So it's a great little way to get more work out of her. No, she works very hard. It's interesting to actually to see just how you're exactly the same work, responsibility. The attitude was the difference between getting heart disease or not. Dear Ajahn Brahm, is nimitta always a white light? Can it be another colour? Thank you. Yes, it can be. It can be all sorts of colours. Colours which you can see in the world and colours which you can't see in the world. Really supernatural colours. Brilliant colours. They're the best. Dear Ajahn, a big, huge thank you for your big tummy. No, our big bright smiles every morning to brighten us up. Thank you for a wonderful retreat as usual. Although my meditation was feces, but that's one that I haven't got here, C-R-I-P, I had a good time being happy. May you have a long, healthy life. I'm not going to follow your instructions. I'm going to have a healthy life if I want to, not if you want to. Why do you want to have a long life for? And a healthy life, didn't I tell you yesterday? A healthy life is merely the longest way to die. That's what it is. A healthy life means you have to wait to die for a long time. It's not going to happen anyway. I just say, like George W. Bush, bring it on. Okay, anyway. Also, three sadhus to our most efficient and kind retreat manager. She's not here. So our excellence. Bianca, can we please dedicate our metta chanting especially for her good health and long life? Maybe she too doesn't want to have good health. All these people wanting to be healthy drives you sick. Anyway, I'll read that out to her tomorrow. Sometimes when you do something wrong, immediately after you realize it, but you are reluctant to own up because of ego or pride. It's not ego or pride which stops you owning up, it's fear of punishment. What should you do in such a situation? I've been saying a few things about that. Where I started getting some new understanding from, this girl came up, Sri Lankan girl, about 18. She came up to me one day and said, after Dana in town, she said, I have a problem, can you help me? Yeah, sure, that's what I'm here for. What's your problem? And she said, I'm pregnant with her boyfriend. And the next day I said, have you told your mum and dad yet? She said, no. My dad will kill me if he finds out. That's what I've come to you for. Can you tell my mum and dad for me? They won't kill you. And of course, I would help out. But then I, from that experience, I thought, my goodness, when a young woman needs their parents most of all, they're scared of telling you. My dad will kill me. My mum will murder me if I tell them. She was so frightened of being punished, scolded, which meant that she was covering up her pregnancy. And she needed someone like me to sort of open it up to her parents. I thought, how sad that is. You may have a son who's got a drug problem. He won't tell you because he's scared of what you'll do. When he needs the parents most of all, they never tell. Because of punishment. You may have a husband who's falling in love with someone in his office, with his secretary or another woman in there. He's afraid to tell you because he'll get hit over the head with a frying pan or something worse. He wants to tell you because he loves you. He doesn't want to have that relationship. It's just the chemistry is pulling him away from you. He wants to stop it, but he won't tell you because he's afraid. How much does fear stop us being honest with one another? And that's one of the reasons why, please, for goodness sake, tell your children, you can say anything to me, son, daughter, anything at all. As long as it's the truth, you will never be punished or scolded. And I will never look down upon you. I'll never shout at you. I'll never take away any privileges at all. Please, any problem, please come and tell me. Tell me the truth. And never be afraid to tell me that truth. Because Mum and Dad are here to help you when, you know, you do some really bad things. It's okay to do bad things. It happens. You know, teenage girls get pregnant. A lot of boys get talked into taking drugs. They need to tell their mum and dad. Which is why that you should always be open to them and say, you'd never be punished, never be scolded, I'll never shout at you, I'll never look down upon you or look at those with those killer eyes. I'm going to be kind to you. And then you can help them. People lie because they're afraid of telling the truth. Politicians lie. Because if they told the truth, they're afraid they'll never be elected. Some politicians have told the truth, and you've kicked them out afterwards. And that's the problem. So that's one of the reasons why punishment drives the truth underground everywhere in life. And it's the fear of that punishment makes us not owning up. What is the Buddhist view on vegetarianism? The answer is complicated. We're going all night with that one. When I meditate, I see two separate things. Me, the one who knows, or making peace and thoughts, desires, peace, etc. Are they conscious and subconscious mind? No, if you're experiencing, it's all conscious for you. So it's just like when you look at me, you can see the brown robes, you can hear the voice, you can feel the metta. There's many aspects to the same moment of consciousness. So that you're not really seeing separate things. You're watching the thing which knows consciousness, and just the sankhara, which is, in this case, making peace, being kind, being gentle. It's what you do and what you see. Thank you. Okay, thank you for spending time with us again to teach us happiness in meditation. May you be well, happy and healthy. The same for all the monks, nuns in the monastery, and also Bianca too. By the way, I realize that all of us actually already entered jhana on the first day. Everyone entered jhana on the first day. They entered jhana grove. Ha ha ha. That's what they say here. It's a good joke. Everyone's already in jhana. Jhana grove. Okay, anyway, I thought that's good. Thanks again for everything. May the Dhamma always be illuminating our world and all beings. Should we visualize the mind as a TV screen and the breath as being inside the screen? Give it a try. It's a reasonable thing to look at. But make sure the TV screen is high definition. Really aware of the breath. A psalm for Ajahn Brahm. A field of merit named Ajahn Brahm serves others with tireless elan. In a moment free from plan, teaches Dharma with erudite charm, holds an audience in his palm, their tender hearts does disarm. Inspired by his noble yarn, disciples rise without alarm, practice sila safe from harm, Train the mind in wisdom and calm. Blindfold Maras enters jhan. See the Dhamma, na Ariyan. So I think you should stick to your day job. No, that's a nice try. Thank you so much for trying. Excellent, thank you. I like sort of humour and just people giving it a try. You spoke about breath meditation. What about meditation on loving kindness? Wishing yourself and your spiritual friends to be well and happy. I'm doing the loving kindness meditation tomorrow if the karma is ripe. So wait till tomorrow and all will be revealed on Metta. If you are in a suffering relationship which makes you think many negative thoughts, should you leave? Or should you stay thinking that you are just paying off your bad karma? If you break your leg, should you call an ambulance and get it fixed up? Or you could just think, I better lay here, I'm just paying off my bad karma. I don't know about you, but if I broke my leg, I'd call an ambulance straight away. Yes, bad karma, I broke my leg, but I've got the chance to make some good karma and heal it. So just don't take on suffering because you think it's paying off old karma. You don't know what old karma you have to pay off. So instead, if you see if you can do something about it, get some sort of counselling, you know, if it's possible, see if there's something you can do. But if you can't do anything, then sometimes relationships have to end. It's the safest thing to do sometimes. Take time out, talk to other people, but don't just stand it and get beaten up. So if it's a suffering relationship, relationships like everything else, they have their use-by date. And so if it's past its use-by date, you've got to be honest to it. You have not made a mistake, your partner's not made a mistake, it's just some relationships last a long time, some don't last a long time. So check the use-by date and don't drink the milk after the use-by date, you'll get sick. Relationships are like that. And I mentioned also, don't feel guilty as well. I failed. The relationship didn't work. It's my fault. It's not your fault. It's the fault of anicca, impermanence. It happens. And don't ever think that it's something bad. Because when the relationships fail, when you get divorced, remember it's not called divorce. What's it called? Recycling, yes. So you get recycled. You've been with one guy, now you get recycled with another guy. You know, and one girlfriend, and yet recycle her. She goes to your best friend, your best friend's one comes to you. Recycle. Sharing. Dear Ajahn, when the Buddha got enlightened and decided to teach humans about Dharma, isn't it will still working? I mentioned that earlier. It's a good question. The Buddha had to get that will from somebody else. He had to be asked. Sahampati, he was the one who caused it all. If he hadn't have asked, the Buddha would have just sat there. So if the Buddha already knew that his, okay, this is the Buddha dying. If the Buddha already knew that his last food was not clean, why would he still eat it? And like you mentioned, he knew the food would kill him. Was it considered a suicide? It seemed not, because the intention was not to kill himself. What is the definition of suicide? Doing something you know will cause your death. Intentionally. And it could be avoided. It was a suicide mission. Getting that last food. So did the Buddha commit suicide? People say, no, it can't be done because Buddhism is pure and the Buddha is the holiest man. That's a terrible thing to do. But did he? I will let you consider that. To be seen every wise person for themselves. But it's interesting, it just starts to make you consider. But it's a waste of time really considering it because it has nothing to do with jhana or enlightenment. Dear Ajahn, could you explain the effect of letting down people under Buddhist principles? This is not about lying, thank you. Letting down people under Buddhist principles, thank you. And this is a very good retreat. Thank you for your devoted service, Ajahn. And also I'd like to thank Bianca, she is great. Yeah, I think what you mean by letting down people, that there's all sorts of Buddhists around, and some Buddhists are just starting off their journey towards enlightenment, they're not that far advanced, and they've still got defilements, they will still manipulate you, they'll break their promises, they will let you down. But you only get let down if you sort of don't understand just what to expect in people. Suffering is asking from life something it can't give you. That's another definition of suffering. It's asking from life what it can't give you. So it might be a sister, a brother, a parent, a child, a really good friend. And you expect them, just because they're a Buddhist, to always, you know, be there for you, never to lie, never to let you down. But of course, that's asking from this world what it can't give you. Even Buddhists let you down sometimes. Even Buddhists can lie. Even Buddhists, you know, can cheat you. They're just, you know, not very advanced Buddhists. So don't get let down by that. Expect it. And especially, I don't know how many times people come up to me and there's either an inheritance or business. For goodness sake, when it comes to business, don't lend your family members money. If they want to get some money from you, get it from a bank. I don't know how many families have messed their relationships up because the brother or son has asked for some money to loan for something or other, and they never ever pay it back. And that just causes so much harm in the family. So when it comes to money, greed, craving gets so strong, much stronger than family bonds. And people go crazy sometimes. And a mother who loves her son who respects her mother, all that goes out of the window when it comes to craving. So be careful. Don't break the relationships of family by loaning people money. That's a bank's job, not mum and dad. You can give them money, fine. But if you loan them, you're not going to get it back sometimes. There's the opposite side. Sometimes the children are good, but sometimes that's a cause for them, their defilements being aroused and drives them crazy. You had a question?
Yeah. Is it not easier to give it to them with no expectation?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. But don't loan it to them.
Yeah,
that's really sort of asking for trouble. Especially if it's a brother or sister or something. Yesterday you spoke about one is fully enlightened. He, she must become a monk within 7 days or they will die as there is no will to live. Can you elaborate in more detail? Not really. The only way to do that is you get enlightened and you can prove it. Don't become a monk. Don't become a nun. And I guarantee you will die within 7 days. And after you're dead, I'll say, there, I told you so. Now, the only way you can really understand it, if you get into a jhana, you will understand what we mean by this will. And you understand just after you're enlightened, that will is just almost gone, if not totally disappeared. No point anymore. So you'll just fade. The will to live, which is an important part of being, just goes. So it's only if you get into deep meditations, you understand what this will is. You understand, I was told that when I was young, I thought that's ridiculous, that's rubbish. But then when you get into these deep meditations, it was actually, this is absolutely true. You understand why it works. Dear Ajahn, did Ajahn Chah speak in English or in Thai? Neither, he spoke in Lao. Did you learn to speak Thai? Yes, but mostly Lao. How did you understand what he said? The only English word he ever learnt, because he went to visit England, went to London for a couple of weeks. When he came back, we asked him, did you learn any English words? And he said, yes, only one. He said this in Lao. And the English word he learned by living in London for 2 weeks was cup of tea. Honest. He was such a joker, Ajahn Chah. Cup of tea, cup of tea. Everyone was saying, cup of tea. That's the only English word he knew, cup of tea. It shows you he had actually been to London. So no, first of all, you could see the body language, and that was impressive. When you didn't understand any Lao or Thai, just the way he acted, that was very impressive. But when you started to understand him, it was really good fun. So we all learned, because I was only 23 when I became a monk. Your brain was really open. And so just living in a place where no one spoke any English at all, you soon learned, just the way that kids learn how to speak Lao and Thai. The trouble was that where he spoke, sometimes he spoke Lao, sometimes he spoke Thai. So when I went to Bangkok and supposed to speak Thai, people were laughing because, you know, I was speaking Lao. And that's like the really low language. That's like the language of sort of the farmers. And so, you know, when sort of being a monk, especially a Western monk, you're supposed to be very, very high class. And you were talking like a farmer's labourer. And they just found that so amusing. Thank you very much, but I love Laotian. Because it's such an earthy language. I told the monks this, they have all these wonderful words. Like the word for a young boy in Laotian is small testicles. Honestly, that's the word, Hum Noi. So they see a young boy, small testicles, come over here please. Such a beautiful language. Thank you very much for all you've taught us during the last 9 days. It is wonderful, and we have a better understanding about ourselves now. May you have a long, healthy life. Oh, not again. And be able to serve more people with your special method of creative communication. They just want to squeeze more out of me. There, okay. And also a very big thank you to Bianca for the great service rendered and to all fellow retreatants for the cooperation given to her. Thanks again. Yeah, we'll do most of the thanking things tomorrow because that's the best time. But a few more questions here. Dear Ajahn, we have four elements and floor has four elements too. How can we know floor has wind, water and fire elements? The four elements was part of early Buddhism and also early early European culture. Fire, air, wind and water. But then later on, quite frankly, that when I learnt that in Buddhism, that was one thing I could never really get my head around because I learnt theoretical physics. It was quarks and there's only three of them. So the four elements made most sense to me at all. But if it's one way to look at life, fine. But I prefer to look at life in subatomic particles and forces and the warping of space-time. Now that was really fascinating stuff. And quantum events. And so when I see the floor, I see these quantum potentialities moving around one another. Look, four elements is really dull compared to quantum physics and subatomic particles and Higgs bosons and everything interacting like that. Wow, that's fascinating. But yeah, four elements if you want four elements. So how do you know the floor has wind, water and fire elements? I don't know. Maybe dry it out, see if any water comes out. Put a light to it, see if any fire comes out. And wind? I don't know about. Well, what can you do with wind? I don't know. Anyway, find out. But you don't have to follow everything in Buddhism. Okay, to me, I can't do that. Four elements makes no sense because of my conditioning. But, you know, some of you haven't had that conditioning. You can see water and stuff in things, so fine. Are we following the breath or watching it? Are they the same? You're aware of it for moments and moments. And because the breath moves, you can say you're following the breath. You're aware of it now. In the next moment, you're aware of it. In the next moment, you're aware of it. It is just like being someone who works for the CIA. So you're always watching it. All the time. And that's like, you can say you're following it. You can say you're watching it. It is the same. Which brings me on to one of those wonderful stories. There was a fellow in Sydney who was very, very upset at how much he had to pay for insurance premiums. He had a big house. And not only did he get the insurance premiums to come down a bit, he installed all these security cameras, CCTV cameras, alarms, double locks on his doors. You know, what it costs to keep people out of your house is enormous. And he got fed up with that, so he decided on this marvelous idea to cut down on the cost of protecting his house. He sold all the security systems on Gumtree or eBay or something, and he sort of cancelled his insurance policy. He never needed it anymore. He didn't need even locks on his door from now on. All he did was put a flagpole in his front garden. And on the top of that flagpole, he put an ISIS flag. And now he has 24/7 security, provided by free, because the CIA is watching him, ACO is watching him, the Australia Federal Police is watching him. so no burglars can come in. It's got free security. All for the cost of an ISIL flag. What a great idea. That was a great joke when I heard that. I read from Ajahn Chah, a book translated by Jack Kornfield. Anything that we do mindfully is meditation. Could you comment on that? That is totally US, totally wrong. And because of that, you had all these New Age Buddhists with Jack Kornfield and having sex. Sex is meditation. Don't you do it mindfully? Do it mindfully and then having sex with as many people as you like. That's practicing lots of mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body. Actually, not my body, but her body. Or someone's body, someone else's body, whatever it was. And that was just... Even Ajahn Chah said no to that. So that's why that, unfortunately, that, you know, that Jack Kornfield is very popular because he tells people what they want to hear. Not actually what people actually, what Buddhism says. So, no. Anything that we do mindfully is not meditation. I mentioned also like thieves, they can rob a bank. They're very mindful when they rob a bank. Honestly. When they go in there, they've got to make sure they don't make any noise. Did you read there was an article about these pensioners in London? They robbed this big bank in Hatton Garden. And they're all, I think they were 70 and 74, and they got away with it on the weekend, a long weekend in London. Hatton Garden was where the jewellery store is. That was a safe deposit place. They're all old people. I don't think there was any one of them was under 60, 65. Pensioner gang. And they were extremely mindful. But would you call that meditation? Robbing a bank? Well, I don't anyway. What is your view about Buddhism in the world nowadays? Is it declining or inclining? Any new trends? Well, I do see that when you are meditating, if you're an example, sometimes you're inclining and you're declining. But some of you are straightening up. So, our Buddhism, especially when it gets to meditation, that's really taking off. They call it mindfulness, but it really is meditation. Next question. Will the knower also vanish when we get enlightened? Yes, it does. That's a very good question. That surprises you. We all think that the knower and the will is my essential self. That's who I am, really. The one who does. Who makes choices, controls things. Or, I am the one who knows. This is me. Unfortunately, that's a myth, that's an illusion. And you break that through in deep jhanas. That really kicks your ass. You really see life totally different afterwards. That's not who I am. That's not the self. That is just a process. But it takes a lot to see that. That is enlightenment stuff. That's the big stuff. What is the view about human existence? I already mentioned human existence is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. Is it the same as Darwin theory? Darwin theory was just noticing the evolution of bodies. But in Buddhism we have the evolution of the mind, the thing which goes into the Buddha, the bodies. Darwin was very materialistic. Never ever had an idea of a mind or a stream of consciousness, just about bodies. So Darwin wasn't bad, but he didn't have the full picture. Can a monk still get dementia even though he practices a lot of mindfulness? I did answer that, I think. I can't remember. Or perhaps it will just lower the chance of severity to have it by practicing mindfulness. If it is through some physical problem, such as you know, a stroke or some damage to the brain because you hit it. Well, even actually Ajahn Chah had a stroke. We never had dementia. Interesting story about Ajahn Chah. He had a stroke, couldn't speak for about 9 years. But every now and again he'd just go into jhanas. We knew he did that because he would just be sitting there and he would stop breathing. He wouldn't breathe for hours. And we know this when it happened once. Many times. There was, let's go back a bit. After Ajahn Chah had his stroke, the monks had a meeting and they said, oh, okay, you know, he's done a good job, lots of teachings, let nature take his course, just let him die. And they had a big resolution to let him die. But this was Thailand. And so the king of Thailand heard about that and he said, no, look after him, keep him alive. And in Thailand, the king has more authority than the monks. So they had no choice, they had to keep him alive. And so the king supplied a male nurse, an 8-hour shifts, 24/7. And the monks did some of the other work, like washing and looking after Ajahn Chah, helping him. And one evening, there's a couple of monks were helping out, and this nurse was on shift when Ajahn Chah stopped breathing. And the nurse panicked. Stop breathing, I've got to get starting again. The monk said, leave him alone, he does this regularly, he's just getting into jhanas. No, I can't do this. And as I often joke, that male nurse knew that Ajahn Chah was going to die one day, but he didn't want him to die on his shift. Someone else's, but not my shift, I get blame, a famous monk. So, he wanted to keep him alive. And the monk said, leave him alone. They came to this wonderful compromise. Every 10-20 minutes, the male nurse took a blood sample. Even though Ajahn Chah wasn't breathing, as long as there was oxygen in the blood was oxygenated, then there was no damage possible for the brain and other organs. And they found after 3 or 4 hours, when Ajahn Chah wasn't breathing at all, not noticeably breathing, the blood was always well oxygenated. How that happens, I don't know. I'm not a doctor, but there's oxygen there all the time, enough to keep the brain just ticking over and keep the heart pumping because it was going round. Where that came from, I don't know, because he wasn't breathing. Sometimes they say it's absorbed through the pores of the skin. I don't know if that's medically possible, but maybe it was. But he's always well oxygenated. So that told us that he was doing his jhanas when he was sick. Couldn't say anything. But he just let go and did jhanas. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you're a very nice, kind monk. You don't know the real me. This is only the persona I show him. The monks know the real me. I'm mean and nasty and revengeful. I hold grudges. You better agree. You better say no, he's not like that. Otherwise, I'll get you when you get back in the room. You know his finger, where he got that from. The other thing... You are a very nice, kind monk. Can we please take photos with you on our last day after the Dhamma talk? You don't have to smile if you don't want to. Thank you. When I was in Indonesia, I was told that the Buddhist monument, Borobudur, in the centre of Java, just outside of Yogyakarta, that was decaying. Now it stood there for all these centuries, and now it was degrading because of people taking photographs, the flashlights, but interacting with the stone, and actually destroying it. That is my excuse. I am decaying because of all the photographs taken of me. It's interacting with my skin and I'm wearing away. Are you buying that? Okay. I'd better take photographs tomorrow then. Anyway, I snuck in a question. Can you please briefly describe how you do death contemplation, please? So one way is, like, I will die, that's for sure. Another way, when you go to bed tonight, lay on your back, put one arm over the other like this and pretend you're dead. Because who knows, you might die tonight. One of these nights is going to happen. What's the average lifespan? 80. 365 nights a year. That's, what's that, 24, about 30,000 nights you're alive. And one of these nights is going to be, every night you've got a 1 in 30,000 chance of dying, of not waking up. And many of you have already sort of, you know, lived such a long time, the odds are descending very rapidly. Maybe it's only 1 in 10,000, 1 in 1,000. That is actually quite possible. people would buy a lottery ticket. It was what, in 10,000. So that might be you tonight. Are you ready to go? Have you written your will yet and left everything to the Buddhist Society of Westminster? So it might happen. But it's only just to get you not scared. It's just so that you can let go of all your attachments. Ready to let go at any time. That's the only reason why you do this. Not to scare yourself. I shouldn't do things like making you scared. Because I ban you from dying. It's not because going against nature, but it's just such a pain in the butt if anyone dies on this retreat. And we have to just arrange with your family and the undertaker. Oh, it's just such a pain. So please wait till you die to go back home. It's just like during the rains retreat. We have this 3-month rains retreat when everybody's supposed to meditate and spend a lot of time. Now, in the monastery, like me, I want to spend some time. I go all over the world teaching retreats. I do a lot of work. Please give me a break for 3 months so I can meditate and have a rest. So I ask people when we do the entry to the rains retreat ceremony, I always make an announcement, please, out of respect. No one is allowed to die during the retreat period. Because if you do, then I have to break my retreat and cancel all your relations and go to the funeral service, and it's just really disturbing. So I ask people, please don't be selfish. Don't just think of yourself and die whenever you want to. Please remember the other people and just die at the right time. Well, what happened is one person died a couple of weeks ago, and they died at 1:30 in the morning. They woke me up in the cave. So I told people, from now on, please, don't die in the middle of the night and come and wake me up. I need my sleep too. Some people, they only think of themselves, they don't think of other people. So that's only messing around. Okay. There's only 3 questions to go, and it's only 9:18. We're going to finish. Yoo-hoo! Is it okay to use the Buddha's name in vain? Oh, my Buddha. The kangaroo jumped over the gates. Give it a try. See what happens. Are you scared? What might happen karmically if you use the Buddha's name in vain? Please take away all superstition, because sometimes we do things out of fear, not knowing what's really happening. Respect the Buddha, but don't be afraid of the Buddha. When do monks chant at the Bodhinyana Hall? Is it okay to go in when they are chanting? It's usually only once a fortnight when we do the Patimokkha ceremony. The next Patimokkha ceremony, was it Sunday week or something? So it's a while before you get some chanting again. Also on the Wednesday evening when, if I'm not here, not overseas, then I give a talk. And we do some chanting then for people. So that's when we do it, Wednesday or on the Patimokkha days. Yeah, you can go in, but what do you want to hear the chanting for? Our chanting's terrible. That's why Buddhist monks chanting is really very, very powerful to get rid of ghosts. Honestly, no, it's happened even here, overseas as well. They get the Christians in, there's a ghost haunting in a house. The ghost just basically laughs at them, doesn't go anywhere. They get the Taoists in, the Hindus in, the Jewish people in. Nothing actually budges a ghost better than Buddhist monks. So we go in there and the ghost has to leave. The reason is because our chanting is so bad, no self-respecting ghost can stay and listen to it for too long. So they run away. That's my theory. But I remember Dr. K.C. Dharmananda in Kuala Lumpur. We gave a talk one evening on ghosts. It was a wonderful occasion because I was telling one story. He grabbed the microphone and he'd tell his story. And I grabbed the microphone back and tell another story. These ghost stories all night. People loved it, especially the ghosts, because, you know, talking about them, they're proud people. They like to be mentioned and recognized. But anyway, he told the story of a neighbor who had a haunting in their house, had a ghost in their house. And again, they got the Christian, didn't work. Then they got the Hindu didn't work, they got the Taoist didn't work, and finally they got him. And when he did the chanting, good Theravada chanting, the ghosts left. Cleared the house. And they were so thankful. But the next day, all the neighbours in the street came to complain, because all he'd done was move the ghost next door. And the house next door was starting to be haunted. So he told me he had to go to every house in the street to do the chanting. So it wasn't just moving the ghost next door, it was actually getting the ghost out of the neighborhood totally. And that's what he had to do. But the Buddhist monks are very powerful doing that chanting. So that is actually ghost chanting. That's our speciality. Yes, Anna? A ghost story. Well, now we've got one more question to do. So I'll do that question first. So we can do the ghost story just before you go outside and walk home in the dark. Asha, what happens to those who do not have any of their senses? For example, the blind, the deaf, can they have jhanas? If you lose your senses, again, you cannot survive, you cannot live. The Buddha said, it's really smart teachings, the four nutriments of life. One is will, the other is sense contact. If you don't have any sense, the other one is food. Food, will, sense contact, and also mind consciousness. If you don't have any sense contact, basically you can't survive. And this is one of the reasons why, if you do have a loved one in a coma in hospital, for goodness sake, talk to them, touch them, stimulate their senses. And there's a good chance you can keep them alive and even revive them. But if you just leave them there, they don't feel anything, they don't hear anything, they obviously can't see, they'll pass away. Because the sense contact, the sense experience actually stimulates them to become alive. So if you are blind and if you are deaf, many of the people who are like that, they can actually feel the sense of touch becomes intense. And they experience the world through touch. But if for some reason they had nothing to touch, they were in a hospital bed or have their fingers in a cast because they broke something, they would die. They need stimulation, sensory stimulation, to keep alive. So that's with the blind and the deaf. So, a ghost story now. Can we have the lights down, please? Now let's think of a nice, scary ghost story for Anna. Ooh, now that's really scary. Okay. Actually, I'll tell a true ghost story first of all, because some people always want to ask, not a joke story, but a true story. Do you know some true ghost stories? And the first one is a personal story, because I was always interested in ghosts and always really wanted to see one. And I wasn't scared of them, because I know actually how they work. And I was travelling in the northeast of Thailand, just walking from place to place, spending a lot of time in the jungles, in the mountains, by myself, meditating, living very, very simply. And when it came to the what's called the Poya days, the one prayers, the moon days, I tried to find a temple just to basically check in with the other monks. And I found this temple with quite a famous monk, Ajahn Suwat, in the mountains of Phupan district in Thailand. And I stayed there for the observance, and afterwards I said, I'm walking now to Sokonakon. That was my next destination, which was about a two-day walk away. And so I asked him, I said, is there any nice caves around halfway? Because it's too far to walk in one day. And he said, yeah, there is a cave about halfway between here and Sokonakon. Many of my monks have stayed there, but you've got to be very careful because there's a very dangerous ghost there. Some of my monks have gone crazy. And as soon as I said that, great! At last, because this was a big monk, a holy monk. He doesn't lie. So I asked him in the details, exactly where it was, what the village was. So I walked there, found the village, asked one of the men there, oh, Anna, you're leaving. Anna's just walked out. Oh. I was closing the door. Yeah. Excellent. Good girl. halfway on the journey there was this cave. I got to the village and I asked one of the villagers, where's this cave? And he took me to it. And it was a very spooky cave. It was a very old cave that had these ancient Buddha statues in there. You know, which if you took them to a museum, they'd be worth a fortune. Very old, because the monks have been in those mountains for centuries. And that's one of the places they stayed. And they set up my mosquito net umbrella, which we used to sleep under. And I waited for the, I asked him about the goats. And he said, yeah, deeper in the cave, you had to sort of, you know, crawl under here and go there. Deep in the cave, there was a skeleton, a human skeleton. He didn't know exactly who that belonged to, but that was obviously connected to the ghost. So I sat in meditation. Okay, ghost, come here. And I meditated, I waited and waited and waited. And about, I don't know how late it was, the ghost never appeared. And I thought, oh, jeez. Sort of, you know, I waited, come all this way, especially to see the ghost, and he doesn't turn up. Ghosts have no respect. So I lay down to go to sleep. I've been walking all day, I was really tired. And as soon as I laid down, maybe 1 second after I laid down, I heard something running towards me. And stopped right outside my mosquito net. Ran and stopped right outside. The ghost came at last. You know what I did? I was so fed up with that ghost. I said, I've been waiting for you all night and now you come. Get out of here, you disrespectful ghost. And I went to sleep. Don't know what happened with the ghost. He probably got fed up with me and left. I don't take any stuff like that from ghosts. They come at the right time or they get out. That's my attitude towards ghosts. But that was so scary, the ghost cave. But some monks go crazy and I say, get out of here. And the other fascinating ghost story, another true story, and this one is for Anna. It's called the tsunami ghost. Some of you may have heard that before. I think I even wrote about it in Good, Bad, Who Knows. This is another true ghost story. You know the tsunami, the Boxing Day tsunami, which killed so many thousands of people, mostly in Indonesia, but also in Thailand, especially around Phuket. And there was a couple, a Thai couple, who were, a Thai lady who lived in the town of Krabi, just to the north of Phuket. A couple of days after the tsunami, she had a dream. In the middle of the night, this Western woman came to her. Her hair, blonde, was all tangled. Her face was all cut with blood dripping down and bruises. And her clothes were ripped and again bloody and bruisy. And in the dream, this white woman said, I'm dead. I'm dead. Help me. Help me. Pretty scary. And then the ghost continued. I was on Phi Phi Island, which is off the coast of Phuket. When the big wave hit, I was killed. I'm dead. Right now, she said, in this moment, my mother in London is trying to call me, but my phone is on the bottom of the ocean. Help me, please. She said, Right now, her body, her dead corpse, is in one of the Thai temples in Phuket Island, which they use as a temporary morgue. Please, she said, go there. Get my body cremated and call my mother. Tell her I'm dead. But don't let her see me like this. Bruised, cut, bloodied. Do the cremation first and then ask her to pick up the ashes. Here's her telephone number. And in the dream, this ghost gave her a series of numbers. And then she woke up. And she woke up with perfect memory of the dream. And she woke up her husband straight away. And the reason I think the ghost went there is because the husband was English. He'd married a Thai girl and settled in Thailand. And she told him the story. And he recognized that was a real English telephone number. So he said to his wife, give it a call. If you know Thai people, you know her answer was, no, you do it. So the husband called that number, middle of the night in Thailand, late in the afternoon in England. Somebody picked up that phone. And after a brief conversation, they realized it was the mother of a missing girl. Her daughter had gone to Phi Phi Island on holiday. She'd been trying to call her daughter. And when they described what she looked like, yes, that was her. And the mother said she knew, as mothers do know, that her daughter was dead. She wasn't surprised. And so she gave this couple permission to follow the daughter's orders, cremate the body, and then call her so she could come to Thailand to collect the ashes. So the following morning, they went to Thailand, they drove there, it's 2 or 3 hours drive. They found the temple, they went inside, and they found the body exactly as she'd seen in the dream. And because the Thai military looking after this was trying to cremate as many people as quickly as possible, they didn't really worry about permissions and paperwork. They cremated the body. And then the mother came the next day from London, picked up the ashes, thanked the couple, and went home. And the couple went home. That night, the Thai girl who saw the woman in the dream, first of all, she had another dream. The ghost came back to her. But this time the ghost didn't look like a ghost at all. Her hair was perfect, like she'd just been to the hairdresser. Her skin, no more bruises, cuts and blood. It was perfect, like she'd just gone to like a makeover in a salon. Perfect skin, beautiful hair, wonderful smile, and this glittering or radiant white dress. Thank you, she said. Thank you. Look what you've done for me. I can't thank you enough, said this girl. Now a deva, we call them devas, heavenly beings, radiant. Thank you so much. Here are some more numbers. And then she woke up, again with full recollection of the numbers. But this time it was not a telephone number. It was the lottery number, which won a few days later. And they made a fortune. The ghosts are like that. I don't know how they can do this, but they know the lottery number coming up next week. So if you ever see a ghost, if you ever hear a ghost, please don't run away. Ask for a number first, and then run. And remember, you've got that information here first. And the poor nuns' monastery needs to complete their road. So please, 50% to Dharmasala, and you can keep the other 50%. Is that a good deal? Very good. And that is actually a true ghost story. Actually happened. Real. The next ghost story, again, a real one, which actually shows you how to deal with ghosts. It's one of the first monks who came to Perth. He disrobed afterwards. But when he was practicing in some of these forest monasteries in Thailand, there were so many ghosts in these forest monasteries, they go there just to hang out. And it was famous for the ghosts in this monastery. And one day he was meditating, like you're meditating. He was in his room, and you know, like I'm me now, my legs are a bit sore. He leaned back and put his legs out and closed his eyes. And he felt somebody tug him. He thought, first of all, it was a heavenly being, trying to, you know, stop him getting sloth and torpor. So he crossed his legs, thanked that being. He actually felt, you know, real feelings. It wasn't imagination, felt somebody pull him. And so he started meditating again. That was the start. When this ghost started coming into his room. And eventually it started playing around with him, poking him, disturbing him. And soon he realized it was a ghost because it came with a bad smell. And it always tended to annoy him. Until one day, he told me this, one day he was meditating there, the ghost came in. And so he scolded the ghost. He said, "Listen, ghost, you sit down here, behave, meditate with me, or you get out. I've had enough of you." And that's the last time the ghost came in. That's how to treat a ghost if you don't want to see them. Tell them to get out of here. Because you are a higher being. The ghosts are lower beings. And because you're a higher being, you have more authority and power, but you just do not use it. You get afraid, just like an elephant with great power gets afraid of a mouse. You're just like the elephant compared to the ghost, who's a mouse. So all you need to do is to tell them what to do and they have to leave. So that's always how to treat ghosts. But always remember, get the lottery number first and then get out of here. And that is how to treat the ghosts. So I think that's enough ghost stories for now. The other thing is, if you are kind to them, just give them some merit, because sometimes they just like a little bit of kindness and share merits with them so they can get a good rebirth. They don't really belong in the ghost realm. So do things like that, and then they will leave you alone. Or sometimes they can actually help you, like the stories I said before. Very often the ghosts are very helpful. They look after you. There was another couple here that they told me, you probably see them. I haven't seen them this week. They often come to China Grove to help give food. They bought a new house. When they bought the new house, the previous owner never told them. So the agent never told them. The previous owner, when he was moving out his furniture, he had a heart attack in front of the door, carrying some heavy furniture, too much for him. So he died right in front of the door. Real estate agent never said that, otherwise wouldn't get the sale. So there's a ghost in front of the door. And when they moved in, their door alarm would be rung. And they'd open the door, no one would be there. At first they thought it was kids playing the old kids game, you know, ring the doorbell and hide under the bushes. But they realized after a while it couldn't have been any kids. There was no bushes there and they couldn't run that fast. And when they heard about the guy who died in front of the house, they realized it was a ghost ringing the doorbell trying to get in. They didn't mind that, but it was just annoying. So you know what they did? Great idea. They took the battery out of the doorbell, thinking that would stop the ghost. But even without a battery, no electric source, the doorbell still rang. Because the ghosts have their own power supply. Interesting thing about ghosts. So you take, there's the doorbell, ding ding, they took the batteries out of the thing and they still rang the doorbell. That's a very smart ghost. Or the other guy who, I think I told the television one, this guy, he had a TV and the ghost kept on changing the channel. The channel changed for no particular reason. Because the ghost didn't like the program they were watching, and the ghost wanted to watch another program. And the solution was just so easy. They kept on turning it back again, you know, hid the remote control. But again, the ghosts don't need remote control. They can do that by themselves. And the only solution which eventually solved the problem, they got, and this is absolutely true, they got a second TV set. One for the ghost and one for them. So the ghost can watch whatever program it wanted at any time of day or night, which it does, just turns it on by itself, and they watch the other programs, what they want to watch. So everyone is very happy. And that's another true story. The weird and wonderful world of real ghosts. Not really scary, but interesting and fascinating. So are you, had enough, Anna?
No.
No. Oh. What other ghost story haven't I told? That's it. I think I've covered them all. So, Anna, you have to find your own ghost and ask its story. And then you can come and tell us afterwards. Okay, I think that's enough. The last question, it's almost 9:42. So, thank you again for listening to the ghost stories. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you for listening. So remember, tomorrow morning is the last day of the retreat. And I've told many of you that it is tradition, it is custom, it always seems to happen, I'm not sure why, that most people get enlightened at dawn. So if you haven't been up at dawn yet, this is your last chance to get enlightened. I'm not saying if you get up early you will get enlightened. Otherwise you get upset at me. I got up, had to bum, it didn't work. But it gives it a chance. See you at dawn tomorrow morning. Okay, get out of here. Here we go. All the questions done. Woohoo.